Shall we go ahead and continue with our means then? So we went through an awful lot of reactions so far. We had the alkylation of amines and an SN2 reaction, but we discussed how that's often a bad reaction, but then we also discussed how that could be exploited to do the Hoffman elimination. We then talked about forming alkyl azides in an SN2 reaction and then reducing those. We talked about reduction of amides, of nitriles, of imines. Along with imines, we had reductive amination. Then we had the Gabriel synthesis. We have the thalamide that we used to do that. We started getting a discussion of aniline and how aniline is so unusually reactive as an organic molecule. I think the only actual synthesis of amines that we didn't address was those Curtius and Hoffman rearrangements that I hadn't shown you yet, correct? So out of that whole list of reactions, maybe we should start there, and then there are some other amine topics that, with the time left, we'll get through. At least you can have all the reactions. Yes? Yes.
What are the topics that
amines, period. Okay. No Fischer projections, no alpha, beta, no DL, no none of that. That will all be on the exam. So this will just be Mondays, Wednesdays, today's lectures, period. All right, so we have the Curtius and Hoffman rearrangements, and I am suddenly blanking on which one is which. Oh my gosh, that's so embarrassing. So I'll show you the chemistry, and then once I remember which one is which, wow. Oh, not a good start to the day. Both of these, it is Friday, TGIF times 50. Both of these in principle can start with acyl halide. So it's another sort of bridge to the previous chapter that we're just coming from of carboxylic acid derivatives. The first of these reactions involves an acyl azide. So we can get that by reacting sodium azide, which, just like hydroxide could attack this and kick out chlorine, azide could attack this and kick out chlorine. There we go. Oh, I know what I'm doing wrong. Excuse me. Trying to do diazomethane. There we go. Now that's not the same structure for azide that I'd written the other day, because as the ion, it would make more sense for it to be symmetric. So have two double bonds, one on each side of the central nitrogen. But this structure gives us a little bit more hint of its reactivity. Because if we look at that, we have nitrogen gas that's trapped here. And nitrogen gas is an extraordinarily good leaving group. You might remember the diazomethane. When I told you about that reagent, I hopefully told you about how explosive it is. And that's, again, because of this ability to release nitrogen. So azides are also explosive in that sense. So what can happen is a rearrangement. And this is a very odd rearrangement, and special in this case because of this azide, where we have an alkyl shift. Remember, we've seen something like this before in the borane reaction. You might, if you can remember way back then, there's a strange alkyl shift that occurs in that reaction as well. And it's also because in that situation, there's a particularly good leaving group. It's unusual, but it occurs. Now, of course, if we move an alkyl group by itself over, taking the pair of electrons with it, we're going to leave a positive charge where the carbonyl would be. So as a response, a resonance arrow we can write here, showing the nitrogen in return, making a double bond. Now, let me throw an R group in here so I can show the more general reaction. Because this will be attached to the nitrogen first, which is double bound to a carbon, which is then in turn double bound to an oxygen. This is a functional group known as an isocyanate. And normally this isocyanate is not isolated. There's a couple different variations of what could happen next. Since we're talking about synthesis of amines, what we would do next is allow this to react with water with just a trace of acid. Now, if you had an isocyanate, let's take a guess here. What do you think is going to happen with acid and water? Like, which of these atoms would most likely react with the acid? The nitrogen, right? Because nitrogen compounds, they're amines, they're bases. Now, this is an imine, but that lone pair is not in conjugation with the double bond, so it kind of can act on its own. And so, yes, it can get protonated. And at the same time, I'll show it in this next step. There's a resonance step we can combine to simplify the number of steps. I'll do it here, because if we have water in solution, it can then attack at the carbon, push that carbon-nitrogen double bond open. This is in principle reversible, although in practice it doesn't reverse. Of course, if we have water attacking, it's going to be protonated, the product, at first. Deprotonation occurs. And we end up with the product. Or do we? Because what is this that I just made? What is it a derivative of? Didn't we go over a small set of carboxylic acids that are thermodynamically unstable? Carbonate, for example, decomposes. Does anybody remember any of the other examples that I gave in that part of the lecture? Well, this is carbamic acid. That name might sound familiar once I said it. Carbamic acid is like carbonate, except one side has a nitrogen. Now, this is a substituted nitrogen, so it's a derivative of carbamic acid. But, and maybe I didn't make this point clear enough when I went over this kind of compound. If we didn't have the hydrogen here, this compound would be stable. If we had a negative charge on that oxygen instead, we could isolate it. But once you put the hydrogen on there, having so many heteroatoms attached to a central carbon makes that molecule unstable. I mean, I told the story about my proposal back at Berkeley, didn't I? Or is that the other section?
The other section.
Okay, so at Berkeley, in order to get your PhD, you go through a couple of hurdles, of course, and it's a little bit different order than what happens at some schools, because some schools you go through all these written exams, qualifying exams they're called, where you memorize a list of 500 different reactions, they ask you anyone they feel like, or something along those lines. And then later on, you have to defend your thesis. In other words, explain the research that you did, why it was important, why you got the results you did, why you should finally be allowed to graduate and get out of there with a PhD. At Berkeley, they do that early, so that if they think that they have some concerns about you or the project, they can tell you early enough so that you don't get to the end of your PhD and they say, oh, sorry, go home, because that can happen in places. You spend 4 or 5 years and get nothing. So after your second year, during your second year, they put you through this hurdle at Berkeley, which of course gives everybody the jitters, but at least, like I said, you find out early if you're going to be able to go on, and of course, I did go on, I did make it here. But there was one of those moments, deer in the headlight moments, I call it, where I was in my defense of a proposal. Proposal is something where you come up with a research plan that if you were an actual researcher, what would you go off and do? They want you to come up with one and defend one to see, could you be a researcher? Can you take what you've learned so far and design some kind of project? Because the point is, some of these people going through grad school are going to end up these researchers. So I'd come up with a proposal that used this molecule. Bromomethanol. which doesn't exist. Because like these other compounds, these single carbon compounds, if you don't have the right kind of bonds, putting too many hetero atoms on there just makes it unstable. So 3 minutes into my defense of my proposal, one of my panel members, who's written an OChem textbook, gets up and says, "So where are you going to get that starting material?" And I recovered, but, you know, it did not start off on a good foot. The point of the story is to then come back to this and say, here's another one of those single carbon compounds, a bunch of hetero atoms, that if we had a negative charge on there, it would be okay. But since we have the hydrogen, and since we're already under acidic conditions in this case, we lose carbon dioxide, which means what do we end up with? An amine. So this is a way of taking a carboxylic acid, going through its acyl halide to eventually get to an amine. Now, there's a variation of this that I won't write down because we really are supposed to focus on amines. Instead of throwing water at that isocyanate, you can throw an alcohol at it, which makes an ester. Esters don't have this problem, so they're carbamic acid esters that you could form. But this is the... Oh, I can't remember if it's the Curtius or Hoffman. That's so embarrassing. But this is the right mechanism, at least. So, any questions on this one? Because the next reaction is very, very, very similar. That's why I don't remember the name from one to the other. Because the next one is not an acyl halide, but it's an amide. And I know we can reduce an amide, but there's actually something about this I'm going to point out once the mechanism is finished. So, what do you think would happen if we took a solution of sodium hydroxide and bromine and reacted it with this molecule? First of all, is sodium hydroxide really basic enough to deprotonate this molecule? Irreversibly? No. Actually, the pKa is probably somewhere up in the 20s. So, no, hydroxide's not the best base. But it is an amide. Amides are very unreactive. Yes, saponification is an issue, but we have bromine here. So there's another reaction that could happen before the saponification. Because you might remember me saying out loud, even if we haven't used it yet, that in amides, the alpha proton is the less acidic proton. It's actually the proton on nitrogen itself that ends up being more acidic. Why? Because it lets you make the equivalent of an enolate, just with nitrogen involved instead. Think of alpha halogenation, like the haloform reaction. We're really doing the same thing, except as you're going to see, the connection occurs through nitrogen, not through carbon. And again, that's because the nitrogen's hydrogen is more acidic than the carbon's alpha proton. Just so I'm not any further embarrassed, since we have these little electronic devices that someone could... What's that? It is the Hoffman. Is it one or two N's?
One or two what?
N, letter N. Hoffman or two?
I was going to say Hoffman, but I knew if I said it, then it would be wrong. Kind of like photocopiers that only break when you need them.
They know how stressed you are. They watch. Okay, so we have alpha halogenation.
Gives us back a substituted, an N-bromo, to use our nomenclature,
N-bromo substituted amide. But what did we learn when we did the haloform reaction? If we did exactly this, we put one bromine on, what then happens? Makes the next hydrogen even easier to pull off, doesn't it? Because of inductive effects. So we're going to remove this other proton as well. So hydroxide more easily takes off the second proton, so you can't stop it, really. And I'm not going to show the resonance structure this time. Because look what we've ended up with. We've ended up with a negatively charged nitrogen with bromine that is a leaving group. So in other words, the structure of this intermediate, sorry, here comes the blue. So there, you can't see the second box, but go back up to the Hoffman rearrangement, and we can see that there's a negatively charged nitrogen that is expelling a leaving group. Here's a negatively charged nitrogen that therefore is going to expel a leaving group. Oh my gosh. So I was going to say the Hoffman before, which means it really was wrong, right? It's because this none. Oh, see, but I was right that I was wrong. Oh, the symmetry of it all. I love it. Okay, so are we totally extra super duper triple sure that this top one is the Curtius rearrangement then?
Yeah,
because you thought I was talking about the one below.
Yeah.
Okay. See, communication's important, isn't it? Curtius rearrangement. Now you make me change it again, though. It's minus a bazillion points. Or could I use the proposed prefix and say hella points? I told that story already, didn't I? That Google was behind the drive to make hella an IUPAC prefix.
What?
The hella, H-E-L-L-A. Oh my God. So you'd have the hella meter and the hella second and all that. Ben, what about heka? You know, what's a heka in terms of hella?
But anyways, off topic. It's Friday, isn't it?
We make that same isocyanate, which because we're already in a solution of hydroxide, we can't prevent it from further reacting. Up top, the Curtius rearrangement, we get the isocyanate, which could be isolated. Many times it's not, but it could be. Or even if it's not, you can select what we use to decompose it. Here, there's already sodium hydroxide, so the only result is going to be making the imine. And we could show an attack with hydroxide, because with hydroxide, you can imagine at some point there's going to be water, because it's deprotonating. So we do a basic attack on the isocyanate instead of acidic. It'll still push that nitrogen open. Even if it pushes the carbonyl open, it's eventually going to be the nitrogen that gets protonated. So instead of writing a whole bunch of resonance structures, I'm just showing you the direct result. Carbonyl. Yes. Yes, okay, and still it's going to get attacked, or will attack water.
which really that's kind of irreversible because nitrogen minus is really basic. Not as bad because we got the carbonyl here, but still. Now technically, since we're still in hydroxide solution, it's going to neutralize the carboxylic acid, or the carbamic acid. But then once we re-acidify, it will cause that same decarboxylation, and we get an amine. Now, one synthetic note, because if we could reduce an amide, why would we do this? Look at the number of carbons in the starting material. You have an R group and a carbonyl. Look at the product. You have an R group, no carbonyl, but that means we've lost a carbon. So you have an amide and reduce it, you get an amine with the same number of carbons the amide had. If you use this rearrangement, then you get an amine, but with one less carbon. Compared to the starting material. The product will have one less carbon in it. So, very similar to the first reaction, because we end up again with this key intermediate where a leaving group's being kicked out. The main difference is one's an acyl halide that we start with, one's an amide that we start with. And those are the last two main synthesis reactions we're going to learn of amines. So the hint I think I gave to section 3 already, but I'll give to you as well, is if we've got these 7, 8, 9 different ways of making amines, what if I were to give you an amine and ask you to synthesize it all the ways you know how? You know, let's say I just pick something random and nothing too mean. Let's say I want you to synthesize that compound. Well, we could start with what? We could put a carbonyl here, make that an amide, and reduce it. We could put one more carbon, do one of these rearrangements that we just had. We could start with benzyl bromide, means one less carbon. Do an SN2 reaction with cyanide, reduce the nitrile, that'll give us this compound. We could take this compound, but instead of a nitrogen, start with a halide, make an alkyl azide, reduce that. We could take, again, this nitrogen without, this group without a nitrogen, put a bromine in there, do the Gabriel synthesis. Use this to alkylate thalamide and then saponify it. What else could we do? We could start with an aldehyde, and we could do reductive amination. We could take an aldehyde, make an imine out of it, and explicitly reduce it. I've just named 6 or 7 right there. Seems like an excellent type of quiz question. But I'm on this side of the podium, aren't I? But is that so cruel if I just listed out for you the whole series of reactions? Maybe because I'm actually not actually feeling so hot this morning. So in my delusional state, what if I were to write down some of these examples? Would you then object so strenuously? I guess we're going to find out then, is what you're telling me, huh? Okay, so what were some of the things I just rattled off? If you take an amide and reduce it, if you take amide with one more carbon, and react it first with bromine and sodium hydroxide, and then with a little acid. If we took thalamide, to simplify and skip a step. Skip a step. We use an alkyl halide and then saponify. What was one of the other ones? Oh, yes. Alkyl halide reacted first with sodium azide, reduce it, acidify it. Reductive amination. How long did it take me to write those down? So it took me 2-3 minutes because I was writing them and saying them at the same time. Multiply by 3, which is the factor that I've already established, that's the fair fudge factor. That gives you 6 minutes to write these down, which leaves you at least 14 minutes to discuss the difference in acidity of aniline and pyrrole and N-ethyl ethanamine, for example. Yeah. Yeah. What were those three compounds I just named that have the pK values of that we had in the lecture on Monday? Were the three distinct compounds that we compared on Monday? I don't know, but since the notes are already posted, you could go back and find out, couldn't you? Wow. Yeah. I didn't even see if I had a crying person there yet or not. So I didn't finish writing all the reactions down, but you get the point, I believe. Now, there are a couple more here, so I'll just point out, you had the list that I gave you Wednesday. Might be a useful list to study. Do we have any questions on any of the syntheses of amines? Because that's it. We've learned all the syntheses, but now there's some reactions of amines we need to cover. Okay, so we were already getting into the aniline example. Did we finish going through how to acylate it, react it, and then deacylate it? So that we're finished with. Did anybody have any questions on that? Because I know we kind of did it quickly, but there wasn't really much more detail to it than that. Aniline is such a reactive compound, because that lone pair so well delocalizes with benzene. And remember, anything that can add electron density to the benzene ring makes electrophilic aromatic substitution that much more favorable. So favorable that in an alkylation reaction, you might not even need aluminum trichloride. It's that activating of a substituent. I think it's at the top of your list, if I remember, from that chapter. That's how well electron density is donated in. So if you don't remember what I'm talking about, we're talking about doing substitutions on aniline, which we are talking about that because it's an amine. To put it simply, it's just too hot. It's too reactive. So to slow its reactivity down, we react it with an acyl halide. Not to acylate the benzene ring, but to acylate the nitrogen. In other words, make an amide out of it. Now, if we did some kind of reaction like Friedel-Crafts alkylation, then we could successfully get monohalogenation. Of course, you still might get ortho and para, not our concern right now. Then, if we want the aniline back, we saponify. So if you wanted to put it in these terms, it's kind of like a protecting group for aniline. It doesn't stop aniline from reacting, though, so that's why I'd say it's kind of like a protecting group.
better to be called an attenuating group, meaning it turns the volume down. It makes it a less powerful reagent. So were there any questions on this? So a descriptive reaction, meaning I'm not going to give you the full mechanism, but something that does show up commonly.
Is that if we use sodium nitrite, gesundheit, then we can make an aryl diazonium salt.
The term aryl means aromatic.
Meaning something like a benzene ring.
These diazonium salts are very, very unstable. I mean, we've seen diazomethane with what are known as aliphatic, non-aromatic diazosalts. They often eliminate to give you alkenes. But these benzene-containing compounds, the benzene ring stabilizes it enough that at least as an intermediate, you can isolate it. Now, there's a whole bunch of reagents that you can then throw at this compound. And I'm not going to make you memorize all these different reagents, because I don't think this reaction, I think this is another one that might not be in your text. But there's, if for those of you who may end up taking the American Chemical Society exam, or those of you who might be chem majors, you need to at least see this term, Sandmeyer reaction. If you react this diazonium salt with the correct reagent, you can get rid of that nitrogen and just put a hydrogen there. So it's a way of getting rid of an amine off of a benzene ring. If, for example, you react it with copper 1 chloride, then you can make an aryl halide without having to do something like aluminum trichloride as your reagent. Remember, we did learn an alternate method of making a chlorine or a bromine on a benzene ring. But what if you had this amine and several other functional groups? Then we can carefully, selectively put the chlorine exactly just where that amine is. If we use the right reagent, we make it a bromide or an iodide or even an alcohol, meaning we make a phenol. So I don't want you to have to memorize the list of reagents, but I want you to know that there is this thing called a diazonium salt. I want you to know that it is sodium nitrite that does this oxidation. And I've shown you just one example reagent of the Sandmeyer reaction. Don't have to know the mechanism of the nitrite oxidation. Some textbooks have it. We're just going to ignore it. This copper chloride, it's thought to be a radical mechanism. We're not going to be worried about the mechanism then. Just want you to know that this particular type of reaction occurs. Okay, now let me think. What else do we have with amines? Well, if we're not doing those, then really that's it for the amine chapter. That's kind of short. Now, I didn't expect to get done this early. Let me ask you, what is scheduled on the syllabus for Monday? Is that our carbohydrates? Okay. So, since we have this time, let's do a little bit of carbohydrate chemistry. I'll ask one last time, though, if anybody's got any questions about amines. Okay. Then give me just a second here. One moment.
off guard, but that's no problem. Let's do some of the simple mechanisms of carbohydrates. So, what is the structure of D-glucose?
1, 2, 1, 4, 1, 2.
So, in terms of right, left, right, right. Well, I just gave it to you. Right, left, right, right. There's D. Allose, altrose, glucose, right? Binary 2, which from bottom to top, 0, 0, 1, 0. You know I'm gonna come up with a song one of these days for these sugars. It's gonna happen. You told me to grade the exams too, so which one you want? What if we have this in basic conditions? What's going to happen? Well, it could deprotonate all the various alcohols, couldn't it? Because the pKa's of those alcohols are probably roughly that of water. But there's something else that could happen as well. Could form an enolate, couldn't you? Ooh. Nope. No hydrogen. And, of course, if we're using hydroxide to deprotonate, that means the enolate could get reprotonated by reacting with water. Ah, no hydrogen. Now, of course, enols are not thermodynamically favorable, so this is reversible. But this is an enediol. It has two different OH groups on the double bond, correct? So what is there preventing the base from reacting not with the same OH group that was converted into the enol, but what about this other OH group? What's that? You're welcome. And again, we can have water around for this to be protonated with. What sugar did I just make? What's the one keto hexose that you've had to learn? We don't know because it's not on the quiz.
It's not glucose. Fructose, yes. But this is not the only reaction possible. Because let's take the same intermediate we had, the enediol. And let's say that instead of the possibility I just showed you of the carbonyl switching positions, let's say the carbonyl reforms exactly where it used to be. So in other words, we'll take the very top hydrogen off in this structure. Now, the way that I'm going to show this is a little bit off, because we currently have a delocalized ion. And so remember, technically, while it's delocalized, even if we put a negative charge where the pen currently is, it's technically an sp2 center. But let's ignore that. You know, let's forget resonance just once. Formally, then, the way the structure's written, yes, this looks like it's sp2. But if we allow resonance to occur, and we ignore the fact that resonance means what we write is not necessarily what we have as the true structure. Well, we've remade the carbonyl. We have the negative charge there. And that technically would make the group sp3. Now, if we ignore sterics or any kind of intramolecular interactions, is there any way that we can control which side that OH group ends up on? In other words, if we had a planar enol, and that becomes a tetrahedral center again, can't the hydrogen be attacked either above the double bond of the enol or the below? Which means I end up with two different possibilities, which formally resolve once this gets protonated. It will make both sugars at the same time. What do I mean, both sugars? Well, notice that the bottom three stereocenters don't get affected by any of this. This is a motif, a theme that's going to come back over and over again, that we can do reaction on one part of a carbohydrate but not have it affect the other. Our two possible products are the one where the top OH group ends up on the right, which when it does, it's D-glucose again. But if it turns up on the left instead, because we made this new sp3 hybridized center, which sugar is this? 2, 3, 4. Yes, it is mannose. And this is something for sure you need to start recognizing, that the bottom three stereocenters in glucose, mannose, and fructose are all the same. And let me make a comment here about this becoming an sp3 center. Once the enolate re-tautomerizes, an sp2 hybridized carbon is converted to sp3, meaning two structures can result. So, as I think I said in lab the other day, we've demonstrated that glucose and fructose are double tautomers. You make the enol, you come out of the enol, you just come out of it differently than the way you went into it. Or, once we make the enol, it comes back to the carbonyl bearing where it was. But because you lost stereochemistry, you know, that's another way of saying it, that right here, we've lost the configuration because it went planar. Sorry, up at the top there. Right there. And so once it reforms, that's why we get the two possibilities. Now we've got just enough time for me to introduce what I'd like you to practice after the quiz as far as carbohydrates. And maybe I won't write it down just because I want to make sure I get to the other class on time. We've talked about the pyranose and the furanose form of carbohydrates. What do those two terms mean? Right, which pyranose is the 6, furanose is the 5. If you had a sugar like glucose or mannose, if I counted, in including the carbonyl, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, sorry, I didn't do very well. 1, 2, 3, 4. 5. We could take this oxygen and make a ring, or we could take the bottom oxygen and make that 6-membered ring. Remember that once we make that 6 or 5-membered ring, there's 2 possibilities that occur, the alpha and the beta anomer. So if after preparing for the quiz you start getting into the carbohydrate chapter, then the next reaction we're going to do after the quiz is to talk about the rings forming and unforming. There's one key term that you might look for as you do this reading. Mutarotation. But since we are so time constrained, let me just ask if there's any last questions. What's the what? The number of the carbohydrate chapter, does anybody know? 22? Okay. Oh, and as far as the pre-lab, we are going to do the luminol experiment as scheduled, but we're going to use a procedure from a different text. Before I send it to you, I want to see what the legalities are as an instructor, because I know we have some fair use provision, but I don't know if that means I can just show it to you, or whether I'm allowed to photocopy it, or if I can post it, or if I can email it. I want to make sure I do it the right way. So, if it turns out that I need to actually physically give it to you, I'll give you a proper lab lecture on Monday on it. The reaction is not that tough to do. You'll just, maybe we'll go through a quick pre-lab exercise in lab itself. But I know you're focused on the quiz, so what I'm trying to say is don't worry about the pre-lab for Monday. I'll just get us all prepared when we come back.